slip right in. I'm on the very heart of you. Sign in, sign on the dotted line.
Well, this is Mental Health Radio. Take it from us. I'm host Sheldon Brown, and Take It From Us is brought to you by Framework. Today we broadcast another interview from madinamerica.com. We've got a relationship with Mad in America, who issue podcasts on their website, and it's a good place to go to get fairly controversial material on Mad in America's views about a whole range of things in mental health. Today, though, this is a bit of a flashback, really. Mad in America have interviewed Professor John Reed. Now, John was with the University of Auckland for a lengthy period of time, and Take It From Us has interviewed him on at least a couple of occasions. Their background, or Mad in America's background, says that Professor Reed worked for nearly 20 years as a clinical psychologist and manager of mental health services in the UK and the USA before joining the University of Auckland in New Zealand, where he worked until 2013. He served as director of the Clinical Psychology Professional Graduate Programs at both Auckland and more recently the University of Liverpool. He's published over 120 papers and research journals, primarily on the relationship between adverse life events such as child abuse and neglect, poverty and psychosis. He also researches the opinions and experiences of recipients of antipsychotic and antidepressant medication and the role of the pharmaceutical industry in mental health research and practice. John is on the executive committee of the International Society for Psychological and Social Approaches to Psychosis and is the editor of that organization's scientific journal, which is called Psychosis. In this broadcast, John discusses his research interests and, in particular, the science and evidence based for electroconvulsive therapy or electric shock treatment. It's known as electroshock in the United States. As I say, Take It From Us interviewed John Reed on at least two occasions when he worked at the University of Auckland. So here's the interview by Mad in America's James Moore.
My interest in sort of madness in general came from my own teenage years when, like so many other people, I was pretty screwed up and trying to figure out where that came from. And so on a good day, I would feel like the rest of the world is completely insane, and on a bad day I would feel like I was completely insane. And so I ended up wanting to study psychology to try and make sense of myself and my family, and I'm not sure I ever did accomplish that goal, but it's largely, I think, like so many other people who get into mental health, it's because of our own difficulties and issues when we're younger, if we're honest about it. And I think that's true of many people in mental health.
And John, you've written extensively about some of the issues, both with medication-based treatments for mental health and also ECT2. And I just wondered when it was that you started to feel that maybe all wasn't right with the way that we support people with their mental health.
Well, my first experience in mental health services was, what, must be 40 years ago now. I was in New York as a nursing assistant in a psychiatric ward. It was my very first experience. And it seemed to me that if you could establish any sort of relationship with the people in there, they would pretty much all tell you about awful things having happened to them. And that's why they were messed up and why they were either hearing voices or extremely depressed or suicidal. But it struck me very early on that the psychiatrist didn't seem to be interested in any of that. And I just couldn't understand that. I was very naive at the time. And I thought mental health services were about asking people what's going on in your life and how's that affected you and what help do you need. I didn't realize it was just about counting symptoms and applying some sort of diagnostic label and then picking a color pill. And that was true 40 years ago. And sadly, it's pretty much true today. There's been some improvement, some pockets of excellence, undoubtedly, but by and large, mental health services around the world are still ignoring what's going on in people's lives, which I find astonishingly sad.
It is, isn't it? As if people struggling with their mental health isn't enough. To label them and then apply potentially damaging treatments on top is not a good place to be. I wanted to move on now to ask specifically about your research into the use of electroconvulsive therapy, or electroshock as it's known in the US. Could you help me understand, firstly, how ECT is used and the conditions that it's most often used to treat?
Briefly, there's an interesting history to that, because it started out as a treatment for schizophrenia, or for people with that diagnosis. I always have to say that, because there's actually no such thing as schizophrenia scientifically. It's not a construct with any reliability or validity. But anyway, it was used on people with that diagnosis. And the original justification for its use, because, as you will probably know, that it's designed to cause grand mal seizures, epileptic-type seizures, which seems an odd thing for medicine to be doing when you've got one branch of medicine trying to help people not have epileptic fits, and another branch of medicine, if it is a branch of medicine, psychiatry, causing epileptic fits. But anyway, the justification when it started back in the 40s was that people with epilepsy did not have schizophrenia, and people with schizophrenia did not have epilepsy. Therefore, in their infinite wisdom, they decided, and you can read this in medical journals of the time, they decided that the cure for schizophrenia must be to cause epilepsy. At the same time, they were injecting people with seizure disorders or epilepsy with the blood of people diagnosed with schizophrenia. So this was the sophisticated beginnings of electroconvulsive therapy. Nowadays, it's not used for people with psychosis or labeled schizophrenia. It's used primarily for people with depression. But actually, the best predictor of who gets it is not diagnosis at all, it's age and gender. So statistically, the most powerful predictor of your chances of getting it if you enter the psychiatric system is being female and over the age of 60. In every country around the world, women are given it twice as often as men, and people over 60 are given it 2 to 3 times as often as people under 60. So that's really the actual criteria in the real world of who gets it, which, before we get into the efficacy and safety of ECT, raises some interesting questions. Why are older women in particular receiving this so-called treatment? And I don't think psychiatry has ever come up with anything resembling an answer for that. In fact, they don't really like to discuss that. The closest I've got to discussions about that are, well, John, you see, this is because older women are more depressed than men or younger people. And then if you ask them why that is and whether it's related to loneliness and poverty and those sorts of things, they say absolutely not, it's hormonal, which is then we realize we're speaking a different language and the conversation grinds to a halt. But historically, when it was first introduced, the other rationale for using it, other than the epilepsy theory, sorry, using epilepsy to cure schizophrenia, the other rationale was that some people with schizophrenia have very, very painful memories of traumatic events. And electricity, ECT, can erase those memories. And you will read that in medical journals also, which is fascinating to me, because I now spend most of my life trying to get psychiatry to adopt a trauma model of mental health. And back in the 40s, they had one. They acknowledged that these so-called mental illnesses were often caused by very severe trauma and memories of them. And they thought the best way to deal with that was to erase the memories by causing enough brain damage or enough memory loss. But of course, as years went on, that was considered unethical. You couldn't acknowledge that you were using a treatment that set out to cause brain damage. And that, as ethical codes came in, it breached all of those, so they could no longer talk about that.
And John, I've observed on social media and on news items and the like some emotive and heated discussions on the use of ECT, particularly for depressive illness, and it's a topic that seems to be polarizing, particularly where anecdotal evidence is concerned. I wanted to ask you, what does our best science and evidence tell us about the use of ECT?
Well, our best science tells us that after 70 years now, there has never been a single study showing that ECT is better than placebo beyond the end of the treatment period. So let me just unpack that a little bit. During the treatment, which usually takes 3 to 4 weeks and involves, on average, 8 to 10 sessions, during that period of time, a small percentage, roughly a third, of people will gain some benefit, some lift of mood. Sometimes some of the studies, that's only perceived by the psychiatrists, and the patients and the families and the nurses can't see it, but the psychiatrists can, which is interesting. Usually it's a subsection of the people given it who benefit at all. But even for that minority of people who receive some benefit in lifting their mood a little bit, that for all of them, that goes within 2 to 4 weeks of the end of treatment. There is no study beyond 2 weeks of the end of treatment showing that it's better than placebo. So you can get, in a minority of people, a temporary lift of mood. And this kind of explains why some people, not many, but some people will swear blind that it saved their lives and that they come back for more, because they will get this temporary lift in mood, which then goes away very quickly, and then they want that lift again, that artificial lifting of mood, which some researchers have compared to the sort of mild euphoria you get with a minimal brain trauma, which is exactly what it is. And that's kind of, emotionally, that's quite a nice feeling. So you can get this temporary lift of mood, and people will come back, some people will come back again and again for that. But scientifically, there's just no evidence that it's better than placebo. I should just explain what placebo is in this circumstance, because obviously it's not a little pill with nothing in it. A placebo in this instance is you give the anesthetic, which accompanies all ECT, because without it, it breaks bones because of the convulsions, and not the electricity. So the person might believe that they have had the ECT, but they haven't. So that's when you compare those two groups, there is no difference beyond the end of treatment. And what's amazing is that that fact simply does not interest the psychiatrists who continue to use it. I've had so many conversations over the years, when you present that research to them, they just look blankly at you and they tend not to try and argue with you or say it's bad methodology. They're just not interested, and they say, I know it works, I've seen it works, I'm not interested in the research you're telling me about, John. And that is that positions them outside of science, and most of us these days believe that medical decisions should be evidence-based, not based on the personal opinion of individuals.
I agree. And John, I think the listeners would be interested to know, how do psychiatrists determine that the treatment has been successful? For example, is the brain scanned before and after in an MRI scanner, or is it based on some other diagnostic test?
In terms of depression, that would be based on a questionnaire. Usually a Hamilton rating scale or a Beck depression inventory. Or sometimes this thing they call a clinical judgment scale, which is simply the opinion of the psychiatrist, which of course is biased. The person who gives the treatment is the last person who should be assessing whether it worked or not, if you want any sort of objectivity. So no, it's not based on any sort of CAT scan or MRI or anything like that. And it couldn't be, because they don't know how it works. They wouldn't know what to look for. So they've never really claimed that they know how this thing works. So there wouldn't be any point giving a CAT scan, except for the adverse effects and the brain damage. They should be scanning the brain, but they don't, because they're also not interested in the adverse effects, which they say don't exist, or are very minimal and very temporary, both of which are totally inaccurate.
Thank you. And John, I've also heard the statement that ECT can prevent suicide. And again, I wondered if this was based on any supporting evidence.
Not a single study, not one, ever, showing that ECT is better than placebo to prevent suicide. There's a considerable amount of anecdotal evidence, and it is only anecdotal, that some people have committed suicide after receiving ECT because of the memory loss and the fact that they can't do their jobs anymore. The most famous of those anecdotal cases, of course, is Ernest Hemingway, who killed himself shortly after receiving ECT, and he wrote, "It was a brilliant cure, but unfortunately we lost the patient," by which he meant he couldn't write anymore because of what it had done to his cognitive function and his memory. But that is not evidence. Those are just stories. I mean, they're true stories, but they're not scientific evidence. But there's certainly no evidence that it prevents suicide.
So, having determined that ECT is at best no better than placebo, you've mentioned that memory loss is quite common after ECT, and are there any other very obvious difficulties that people have once they've been through a course of ECT?
No, not really. The major, there's lots of temporary ones, like quite severe headaches and confusion, disorientation, but those genuinely do go away after a few hours or days. So the only major sort of ongoing adverse effect is memory loss. And there's two types of memory loss that are caused by ECT. One is the loss of short-term memory, which is, you know, the capacity to remember new things. And the other is the loss of long-term memory. So people sometimes describe losing 5-10 year periods of their life. They can't remember getting married. They can't remember graduating from high school, or they actually lose several years of their life. So everybody loses some memory after ECT. And for some people, that memory slowly comes back. For other people, it doesn't. So very, very roughly, because sadly they don't do enough studies on this, but roughly a third of people will have ongoing serious memory loss. And by memory loss, by serious and ongoing, I mean memory loss of a nature that can be debilitating in one's life, lasting for at least a year. And this, they don't like it when we call it brain damage, but I don't know what else to call it when it's a change to the brain that causes long-lasting or nearly permanent memory loss. I think brain damage is the appropriate word to use. I don't know what else to call it.
And John, there seems to be evidence of the increasing use of ECT. In April 2017, The Guardian reported that there's been a rise of 11% from 4 years ago, and that on average individuals undergo more ECT procedures than before. So given the lack of clear evidence, the high relapse rate, the cognitive and memory impairment, and the difficulty separating the effects of ECT from medications, why does psychiatry have faith in ECT?
I'll just correct the increase bit there, because The Guardian was wrong there, and I had several conversations with their journalists. Those were sort of random non-statistical blips. Okay. in what is actually, it has plateaued. It hasn't continued to go down since the 1980s. It has been dropping steadily in just about every country. And in the UK, it's starting to level out now. And it may well start to go up, but it hasn't yet. There are parts of the world where it's rising steeply. Australia is one which has gone completely down this rather simplistic biological approach. It's adopting an American model, much to the disadvantage of Australian citizens. And Texas also has gone a bit ECT crazy, shall we say. But why do psychiatry continue to use it? Well, first of all, most of them don't. I think it's revealing in its own right that very crudely a third of psychiatrists think it's a wonderful thing. A third will use it very, very rarely as an absolute last resort, which is what the NICE guidelines say it should be used as. And a third will not touch it with a barge pole under any circumstances. Mm. That tells you something in itself right there, I think, that these decisions are about personal opinions, because if either a treatment works or it doesn't, and if it works, everybody should be using it or offering it. And that tells you that some psychiatrists at least are interested in the research and are refusing to use it. And that's quite considerable numbers. You won't find anywhere near those numbers not using antidepressants or antipsychotics. So it's going to be fairly negative, the research, before that number of psychiatrists refuse to use it. So, but to answer your question as to why the psychiatrists who do use it, because they genuinely think it works, James. These are not bad people. They're not stupid people. They genuinely believe it works, and they see it working in their mind's eye. They treat people who are extremely depressed, extremely suicidal. And yes, giving people 150 volts of electricity to the brain can get people who haven't spoken for a while speaking, or who haven't moved for a while moving. And this looks like a cure to them. And they may not see those same people 5 or 6 weeks later when their depression is at the same level again or even worse. The problem is you can get those sorts of results with cocaine or I'm not advocating that. I should add quickly. I'm just trying to make a point that it is not difficult to artificially lift somebody's mood But if you do it in a way that does not address any of the reasons that the person's depressed in the first place, and you do it in such a biologically crude way as to apply 150 volts of electricity to brain cells that are equipped to deal with 1/1000th of a volt, roughly. It's not, you don't need to be a rocket scientist to know that this is going to burn out the brain cells, quite literally. So even though it does lift some people's mood, it is absolutely not a safe way to do that.
It really does seem to be something based on faith rather than evidence.
Indeed. I think that's a fair description, yeah. But it's a genuine, I'm quite harsh sometimes on psychiatry. I know that, but I think, so I have to say, this is a genuinely well-intentioned thing that these people are doing. What I can't understand is that, you know, most people are well-intentioned towards people in distress, but people who are medically trained should know that they must, as well as that well-intention, must base their decisions on some research. They can't just do it on the basis of what they believe to be the case. It's just not good enough, and it brings their profession of psychiatry into disrepute.
And John, I read in your literature review that there haven't been any placebo-controlled trials for ECT since 1985. Is that the case?
Well, yes, 1985. Isn't that amazing? And by 1985, that was the last one of the four that have ever been conducted, ever, that looked at comparing placebo with ECT after the end of treatment. And you would think, if this was a real branch of medicine, if you've got a treatment that's been around for, at that point, for about 40 years, and we haven't got a study yet that shows that it's effective, you've got one of two pathways to follow. One is stop using it. B is invest a large amount of money in actually doing the research to demonstrate that it does work. And psychiatry has done neither of those two things. And they haven't done another study for the last 32 years. That's not okay.
Well, John, I had to read that fact several times for it to sink in, because given how much risk there is inherent in this procedure, I naively assumed that there was a mountain of science and evidence that carefully balanced the risks to the benefits. But your discussion paper completely blows that away. ECT really seems to be based on the flimsiest of science, doesn't it?
Well, it's actually based on no science at all, is the bottom line. So, yeah, there's no science there. But we've had instances throughout history where this has been the case. We just like to think that these days we don't do that anymore. I mean, we had two decades of lobotomies before that was stopped. And at the time, people were equally well-intentioned and must have seen some benefits. Usually it was along the lines of people who were very agitated and quite manic, calming down, which is what happens when you cause those sorts of lesions in the brain. But they thought that worked for a while. They had no research evidence to support it, but they did it anyway. And then if you keep going back, you get the surprise bath, the rotating chairs, the bloodletting, and so forth. And people say, John, what's that got to do with what's going on today? Don't be silly. And I say, well, it's got everything to do with what's going on today, because we have no evidence for this, and we're doing it anyway. And I'm quite sure that in 20 years' time, there will be a radio interview taking place like this, when we look back on ECT, and it'll be in the same basket of ridiculous, failed attempts to deal with madness as lobotomies and rotating chairs and surprise baths. It'll be in that basket. The sooner the better.
I agree there, John, and hopefully we can also critically review the liberal prescribing of many psychiatric drugs too.
Indeed, and I think the answer to all of these issues is the principle of informed consent. So although personally I do advocate for the abolition of ECT, because it's just so far beyond science and ethics, but when it comes to other things, I tend to sort of think that we should rely on that issue of informed consent, whereby people should have the right to take various medications if they have been told fully what the pros and cons are, and if they have been offered alternatives. That's what informed choice means. In terms of ECT, if people were genuinely told the chances of memory loss and death, which we haven't come on to yet, I don't think anybody would take it, except having said that, sometimes people get to such a low point that they will try anything, and that's understandable. But it's still very important that they're told fully what the evidence says. So I should just mention the death rate from ECT, which is low, but it's significant. And the major causes of death from ECT, unsurprisingly, are cardiovascular failure, given that you are causing a grand mal seizure and you are having a general anaesthetic. I mean, the general anaesthetic by itself has a very, very low rate chance of death. And this is what psychiatrists say is the rate of death. They say it is the same rate as the rate of general anaesthetics, which is negligible. And immediately you realize that they're playing silly games with something very, very important, because you tend to get 8 ECTs within 3 weeks and therefore 8 general anaesthetics within 3 weeks. So there's a multiplying of the risk of death right there before you even get into the deaths from cardiovascular failure. So it is small, but it is definitely a significant risk. And that is never mentioned to anybody receiving ECT, and I think that borders on negligence.
Well, the news stories that I've seen over the last few months were big on the anecdotal experiences, but much less so on the lives tainted, ruined, and even ended by having this procedure.
That's right. And I actually believe it and at an individual level, it's possible that it can save somebody's life, because placebo effects are very, very real, and for this sort of procedure, very effective. I mean, it's almost like having an operation. I mean, there's a theatre, you're rendered unconscious, there's lots of nurses around, there's a doctor around. This is a big procedure. So obviously, you're going to believe that it works. People would not do this to you if it didn't work, would they? And when you're feeling depressed, you badly want something to work. Placebo works in terms of creating expectations. And that's not a bad thing at all. A lot of what us psychologists do is building people's expectations and building up hope. That's not a bad thing. But that's, when it does work, that's how it works. I've been through this treatment. I must be feeling better. Oh, I am now feeling better. I know it sounds strange, but we can talk ourselves into feeling better. And we all know that's sort of, in a way, a cornerstone of cognitive therapy is to replace negative thoughts with positive thoughts, and the cornerstone of positive psychology. So it's important what we tell ourselves. So if we go from there's no hope for me, there's no hope for me, it's all over, to I'm having this treatment, obviously it's going to help me, and I am noticing that I do feel better now and again. So placebo is a real thing, and it's important. And if ECT didn't have all these awful side effects, these depressing side effects of losing one's memory, then I wouldn't be banging on about it like I do, because placebo is okay, but what isn't okay is causing brain damage.
We're all for these things having benefit, but it's quite clear when you weigh the potential for harm against the potential small, likely transient benefit that you might get, the equation just doesn't balance, does it?
Not really, no.
John, thank you. And was there anything else that you'd like to share with the listeners?
Just briefly, though, then the next thing coming down the pipeline as ECT fades out, it will fade out, is this new approach for using low levels of electricity to stimulate people's brains when they're feeling depressed.
Is that TMS, transcranial magnetic stimulation?
That's the one. And that probably will work for some people along the same lines as I mentioned before, of it's not difficult artificially to stimulate the brain, either chemically or electrically. And just worries me a bit, there's a sort of 1984 element to it, where you can picture people can do this themselves. They can just have a little trigger in their pocket or a little button in their pocket where they can sort of give their brain a bit of a buzz if they start feeling a bit low. And it just scares me, the idea of people walking around the streets electrocuting their own brains if they feel a bit sad. And I don't know, that sort of does worry me about the future, not only for those individuals, but for society at large, because I think if you look at it at a political level or a societal level, if we've got large numbers of people walking about depressed, and if we take our antidepressant prescription rates as a guide to how many people are depressed, then we have about 1 in 10 of us are sufficiently depressed, apparently, that we need antidepressants. If we have large numbers of people walking around depressed, then we really, really need to be asking questions about what's wrong with our society. That so many people are depressed. And why, for instance, women are twice as depressed as men, et cetera, et cetera. We need to be asking those questions, not asking how we can artificially zap people's brains so we don't ever feel sad anymore. That kind of scares me. But that's why I say it's in the future, but they're rolling out quite a lot of research around that.
We seem to be obsessed with finding a cure for depression, don't we? And of course, I'd love to find something to help people like me that do suffer with their mental health. But while we continue to focus on ketamine and TMS and other things, we perpetuate the myth that these difficulties have a biological basis when there's no evidence for that.
I think so, but I start from the premise, a completely different premise from some of these people, of course. They start from the premise that depression is caused by a thing called depressive illness. And that's why we have this depression, because we've got depressive illness, which is a sort of backward circular loop, which is kind of a bit primitive, I think. It doesn't really explain anything. It's like saying, when I feel happy, that's because I have happiness syndrome, which causes me to feel happy, which is just, it's just rubbish, really. It means nothing. So I start from the equally simple supposition that depression is largely caused by depressing things happening. Not entirely, because some people can have the same depressing thing happen and feel sad for one day, and the next person with the same depressing thing will feel sad for a year. So obviously we have individual differences, but if we lose sight of the fact that there's a lot of depressing things going on in our world, some avoidable, some not avoidable. I mean, people die and things happen that are very, very sad. But that's not an illness. It's not an illness. And I think we go down the wrong route once we start assuming that we can identify bits of the brain that are causing our depression. And the myth of the chemical imbalance has now been totally blown out of the water in the last 5 years. Many of us have been pointing out that it was a drug company invention for 20 years, but now we have the research showing that it's just not there. There is not a chemical imbalance that causes depression. But millions of people have swallowed that lie. And it's in a way, it's a slightly comforting lie, because it means we haven't got to deal with the depressing and messy things in our lives. And it's a simpler and in some ways easier thing to deal with. You know, there's something just a bit wrong with my brain. But then it kind of doesn't encourage you to do anything to make things better, does it, if you think there's something wrong with your brain?
You're with Take It From Us on 104.6 Planet FM.
Do you ever feel like a plastic bag drifting through the wind, wanting to start again? Do you ever feel just so paper thin, like a house of cards, one blow from caving in? Do you ever feel already buried deep, 6 feet under screens, but no one seems to hear a thing? Do you know that there's still a chance for you, 'cause there's a spark in you, you just gotta ignite the light and let it shine. Just your original cannot be replaced. If you only knew what the future holds, after a hurricane comes a rainbow. Maybe a reason why all the doors are closed, so you could open one that leads you to the perfect road. Like a lightning bolt, your heart will glow, and when it's time to know, you just gotta ignite the light. Just on the night, like a 4th of July, 'cause baby you're a
Well, that's Katy Perry with Fireworks on Mental Health Radio, Take It From Us. And I'd say that the interview between James Moore, the interviewer from madinamerica.com, interviewing Professor John Reed, well, there was some fireworks in those, some of those opinions. And it's shocking to think that the future could hold, that people with depression could be walking around selectively zapping themselves, zapping their brains with small electric shocks. That was the suggestion from John Reed in that interview. John's view is clearly for the abolition of electric shock treatment, and it might surprise people, listeners of Take It From Us, that in fact there are up to 250 patients who receive electric shock treatment in New Zealand. You can confirm that and check that out in the annual report of the Director of Mental Health, Dr. John Crawshaw. His next report will be due out sometime in December 2017, and ironically that will be for information in the 2015 and 16 year, but I'm sure that report will confirm that there's been a stability, if you like, a sort of a consistency over the last 4 or 5 years that 250 patients receive electric shock treatment within our mental health service. Let's move on to Mental Health Awareness Week, which is coming up in about 2 weeks' time. I'm afraid it's my view that our Mental Health Awareness Week, as per so many years in the past, is the best kept secret among awareness weeks in New Zealand. It usually clashes with breast cancer awareness, and that is very high profile, takes centre stage during that week that Mental Health Awareness Week is on. Now, the actual dates are from 9th to the 15th of October, and part of that awareness week marks World Mental Health Day. I'm not sure exactly what day that is, but that's normally marked with something that happens at the Auckland University of Technology. Now, the Mental Health Foundation organises New Zealand's annual mental health awareness under a contract with the Ministry of Health, and it invites us on its website to get ready to unlock one of the biggest secrets to well-being, and that is the theme of staying in touch with nature, or that nature is the key. It says, last year we connected with nature for good mental health and well-being, and we were blown away by the support and enthusiasm for the theme. So we're doubling down again this year and looking to nature to grow, support and nurture our mental health and well-being. The Mental Health Awareness Week lockout, just I'll explain that, is returning for a second year on World Mental Health Day. In fact, that's the 10th of October. We're encouraging employers to lock their staff out of the office for an hour and give them the opportunity to connect with the ordinary nature around their workplace. Last year, hundreds of workplaces downed tools for picnics, walks, climbing, footy games and more, and we think it will be even bigger this year. More information about this great event is coming soon, and you can check out the Mental Health Foundation's website at mentalhealth.org.nz for information about Mental Health Awareness Week. I must say that there are some good stories about people connecting with nature. There's a whole lot of related stories. One involves the New Zealand Rugby Union, which says helping its employees to get out of the office and into green spaces is key to keeping the organisation at the top of its game. And Maori communities are focusing on enabling those communities to bring nature indoors during Mental Health Awareness Week. And I understand from the Mental Health Foundation's website that there is a growing number of enviro schools. Enviro schools include early childhood learning centres and primary schools through to high schools. There are close to 1,000 of these new schools in New Zealand participating in the program, with about 250,000 people involved. And of course, Enviro schools are very much about introducing nature, veggie growing, that sort of thing to school children. And it quotes a person, Michelle Duckett, who says, "We know there's really positive things that can happen from the constant exposure and revisiting of natural places. Research shows that kids who have lots of regular opportunities to get out and revisit places in nature have positive impacts on their well-being. Many studies show the positive links between direct experiences in nature and children's mental, emotional and physical health and well-being." And that's definitely, that's reported by the Department of Conservation often. It says kids getting out in nature can increase self-esteem and resilience against stress and adversity. Well, I must have been doing the right thing when I took my grandson to the zoo last weekend. We had a wonderful time seeing all the animals, although I must say it was quite a hot day and there wasn't a whole lot of movement among zoo animals on that particular day, but it was a great experience. And the zoo certainly has a whole lot of children's attractions outside of the animals. There's another profile which is lovely to read on the Mental Health Foundation's website, and it's about somebody who lives on Waiheke who gets a daily dose of natural therapy, which she says does wonders for her. And she says, "Turning her face to the sun and feeling the wind in her hair and sand between her toes is therapy for Deborah Wallace." And she gives this to herself most days. And she says it's the remedy she recommends to those she counsels as a marriage and family therapist. The beach and native bush on the beautiful island of Waiheke is where she turns to process her emotions, reframe any negative thoughts, and also get the exercise her body needs. Nature, and we're talking about nature because nature is key, is the theme of Mental Health Awareness Week. She says nature is also where her family spends time together to play and take time out. She had her own experiences with depression and also with caring for her mother who had depression. So Deborah says her love of nature as body and soul food began when Deborah was 17 after her mother was diagnosed with severe depression. Looking after her mum was challenging and took its toll emotionally on Deborah, who began to realise she herself was down a deep black hole. From reading handouts on depression from my mother's therapist, I realised that I too was suffering. This provided relief because I finally identified the problem and could learn new skills to solve it. After just a few counselling sessions, Deborah quickly learned that actions speak louder than words and committed herself to making daily changes, such as running. Exercise outside lifted her mood and allowed her to take control of her life, outrunning the symptoms of depression. She says also that mindfulness helps her, the turning point in her recovery from her later postnatal depression and grief came when she again took refuge in nature and exercise. Biking, yoga, hiking and mindfulness were some of my main ways of processing. When I couldn't go outside, I would visualise scenes from my favourite hikes. And there are some wonderful hikes on Waiheke. One that was mentioned on Country Calendar a couple of weeks ago where Sir... the Fenwick family have developed a walk on their property which has been open to the public. So let's take a music break and we've got Life in Sunshine with Jamie McDell. Oh, we haven't? We haven't got Life. Hysteria. Oh, we've got Hysteria with Def Leppard.
You're with Take It From Us on 104.6 Planet FM.
Well, this is Mental Health Radio. Take it from us. I'm Sheldon Brown, and it's the show is brought to you by Framework. We're talking about Mental Health Awareness Week, which starts on the 9th of October, runs through to the 15th, and part of that is marking World Mental Health Day, which is the 10th of October. I would ask listeners and others if they have any information about events happening in Mental Health Awareness Week, then if they could get in touch with me at sheldon.brown@framework.org.nz. I have one other event which is being run by Changing Minds, and it's called the Mad Hatter's Tea Party. It sounds like a whole lot of fun, and it's as part of Mental Health Awareness Week. Changing Minds is encouraging businesses to raise awareness and open up conversations around mental health by throwing a Mad Hatter's Tea Party. Now, you can learn more about this on the Changing Minds website at changingminds.org.nz, but that sounds a pretty exciting little event, and I have to say, in terms of Mental Health Awareness Week, that Changing Minds CEO Tammy Allen is an absolute wonder in coming up with brilliant events. Last year, she invited Take It From Us to sort of compare and host an event out in West Auckland, underlining just how tough it is for creative people, singers, dancers and actors in their profession, and the fact that they have such inconsistent work, and it's in those downtimes when they're not being paid that their mental health is often at threat. So anyway, Mental Health Awareness Week, October the 9th to the 15th. Let's take another music break, and this time we're going to play Life in Sunshine with Jamie McDowell.
This time today it's warm outside. Today we're fine. These days we live our lives like there's more to see, but I've come to realize what's in front of me. This is life right now, so turn up the radio, sing this song out loud, and there's no turn the beat up higher.
Take It From Us on 104.6 Planet FM.
And just a reminder that the interview between James Moore of madinamerica.com interviewing Professor John Reed will be available on Planet FM's website at www.planetaudio.org.nz/take it from us. And we'll also have an edited version which we will upload to the Take It From Us website, www.takeitfromus.co.nz. Later this week. So just a reminder that Take It From Us's website has about 20 shows of the most recent shows. And, of course, the Planet FM website has the latest 4 shows in full. So we really encourage you to listen online there. You can even listen on your mobile. So, yes, that's been Take It From Us for another day. And one thing I'd like to mention is that Declan Curran is back. He was our producer some years ago. He's been away from Auckland, and it's great to have Declan back.
Thanking you. Yes, good to be back. Hopefully we'll be bringing you some good stuff. I know we will, because Sheldon's up there with all the goodies.
That's great then, Declan. Thank you, and thanks for producing a very professional show today. That's Take It From Us. We'll be back next Tuesday at 12:30 on Planet FM 104.6.
Catch you then.